tomorrow for strong southerly winds coming off the Alaska Range.
The Stewart Creek fire flares back up. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a FedEx plane makes an emergency landing in King Salmon.
It just happened and we're still gathering the facts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
U.S. and Canadian Coast Guard personnel and several fishing vessels are currently looking for two people out of a group of three after their boat sank last night off Cape Omni on the southern end of Baranoff Island. A confirmed survivor was rescued off the beach this morning by members of the fishing vessel Otter. Neither the Coast Guard nor Alaska State Troopers are releasing the identities of anyone involved. The confirmed survivor is en route to Sitka at this time. The boat, a recreational vessel, reportedly sank at 8 p.m. last evening while the three were returning from a camping trip. All three people had attempted to swim to shore wearing life jackets. The search is centered east of Cape Omni and south of Port Alexander, a small community on the tip of Baranoff Island. A FedEx plane needed to make an emergency landing today at the King Salmon Airport. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the story.
The plane landed safely just before 1 o'clock Friday afternoon. The airport heard a call from a FedEx MD-11 that needed to land at the nearest available airport. Paul Hansen is with the State Department of Transportation at the King Salmon Airport.
They just called in wanting to come on in. And of course, you know, the runway supports that type of aircraft. So we just stood by for the ARF, you know, and if it in case, in the unlikely event that something bad were to happen, we just stood by. And like I said, he landed without incident.
The aircraft was flying from Incheon, South Korea to Anchorage with a crew of two. Scott Feeler is a spokesperson for FedEx. He says the FedEx Express Flight 92 experienced an unspecified technical issue.
It just happened and we're still gathering the facts.
Aircraft maintenance crews were dispatched from Anchorage.
We'd have to evaluate what the technical issue is with the aircraft, and depending upon that, it is the amount of time it would take to repair the aircraft.
Fiedler says the plane was carrying overnight packages from around Asia sent to the United States. In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski wants the Army to explain why artillery was used against the advice of fire managers in a training exercise, possibly starting a wildfire that has cost $19 million so far. The fire started June 19th on military training grounds near Fairbanks. It burned about 133 square miles, three cabins, and two outbuildings. Colonel Ron Johnson, garrison commander at Fort Wainwright, has said the fire was caused by artillery training. But since then, the military has stepped back, saying it's too early to determine the cause. Murkowski yesterday introduced language in the 2014 Defense Appropriations legislation calling for an investigation to be concluded by April 15th. A subcommittee approved the language, and the bill now goes to the full Senate. Meanwhile, hot, dry, windy weather has operations ramping back up on the Stewart Creek wildfire east of Fairbanks. Crews battling the month-old 85,000-acre fire have been demobilizing, but Fire Information Officer Terry Anderson says the weather has put that on hold.
It's on hold now. In fact, we're adding another crew today to continue to reinforce some of our burning out operations there and just being able to do some scouting and some hot spotting on any of these flare-ups that are happening.
Anderson says the new activity is on the fire's east side within fire lines put in south of Chena Hot Springs in recent weeks.
A lot of that's 100-foot to 200 foot of black line on the perimeter that's cold. But inside of that area, there's still quite a bit of hot actively smoking and actually flaming fuel now because of everything's drying out again. So we're going to have crews in there hot spotting and trying to just kind of keep a hold on this fire, and we'll be running our air support with the scooper water dropping airplanes there as well.
The Stewart Creek fire is one of several interior blazes flaring back up. The others are to the southeast. The Moon Lake complex near Tok is also seeing pockets of fuel burn. Anderson says Alaska is experiencing an uncharacteristically late fire season.
We're in red flag conditions again today and tomorrow for strong southerly winds coming off the Alaska Range.
Anderson says moisture is forecast to move into southern areas of the state, but much of the interior is expected to stay dry. He says winds could blow smoke into populated areas. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hot weather in the interior raises flood concerns.
So we're seeing significant glacial melt from the higher mountains in the Alaska Range, specifically in the eastern Alaska Range.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
King salmon numbers for the Susitna are looking better than other runs in the state. From Talkeetna, KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Statewide returns for much of the king salmon fishery have been disappointing. The Kenai and Yukon rivers are both posting numbers well below their goal. Fishing restrictions for king salmon were tight in much of the northern Cook Inlet region, but the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says that they are paying off. Single, unbaited hooks were mandated in most areas, and many stretches of the Susitna drainage were catch and release only. Area manager Sam Ivey said in June that the restrictions were designed to compensate for what was expected to be another below-average year for the King Run. Now that aerial surveys are nearly complete, Ivey says that the majority of the Susitna and its tributaries are likely to make their escapement goals. Ivey says that streams such as Willow and Montana Creeks are likely to make their goals for the first time in 6 years. He believes the fact that larger, older fish are returning is a good sign for years to come. Overall, Ivey says he's seeing more density of king salmon in spawning areas than he's observed in 5 or 6 years, and he credits the strict regulations for some of the encouraging numbers. Though this year's returns are on the upswing, Ivey says that it's important to remain conscientious when it comes to king salmon management. Kings are not the only major species targeted by anglers on the Susitna, however, and early estimates of a strong silver salmon run seem to be coming true. The fish weir on the Little Susitna River is recording above average numbers for this time of year, and Ivey says that pink and chum salmon are also coming in good numbers. The silver run is expected to reach the northern areas of the Susitna drainage in large numbers soon, which is another encouraging sign for area fishermen. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A fight is percolating over a planned solid waste project in Chugiak. Iklutna Incorporated, the Alaska Native Village Corporation there, has requested approval of the municipality of Anchorage to create a site for what the corporation is calling an inert waste monofill. But outraged neighbors are calling it a garbage dump. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Garbage is the new gold. Iklutna Inc. has plans to get into the solid waste removal business and has asked Municipality of Anchorage permission to construct a monofill station on corporation land that is within the bounds of the municipality. But neighbors Spaya and Robert Worthington say that the Native Corporation ought to build it somewhere else. They are 40-year residents of the area and point out that the proposed dump site would impact the quiet nature of their residential neighborhood.
We are shocked that they want to put this in a residential area. It is literally surrounded by parks and businesses and churches and schools and the senior citizens center and the post office and the walking trails. It is just right in the middle of all of that.
The land land is located in between the old and new Glen Highways. Iklutna has filed a master plan with the Muni's Community Development Department for 68 acres. 17 of them would be used for the monofill project. Erica McConnell, who handles current planning for the Muni's Planning Department, says Iklutna's plan states the site is full of gullies that would be ideal containers for the waste. Not so, say the Worthingtons.
We drove back there where they want to fill what they call gullies, and they're actually very beautiful natural ravines that are covered with beautiful trees and sloping hillsides. And the materials that they want to put there, apparently they've had a problem with those in the municipal landfill. It's messed up their leach fields, so they need to find somewhere else to put them.
And mess up leach fields elsewhere.
That's how we see it.
McConnell says the type of fill would be debris from demolished buildings, what's left after toxic materials and recyclables have been removed. That's about 25% of the rubble left after demolition.
As their application describes it, an inert waste monofill would take construction debris, anything that can't be recycled. So wood, plastic, foam. It would not include any household garbage, any liquids, or any type of putrescible waste.
McConnell says the plan would allow Iklutna to haul in fill for 30 years, then convert the property for other uses. McConnell says Iklutna's master plan contains a request for a conditional use permit for the monofill project.
And they are required to get master plan approval from a recommendation from the Planning and Zoning Commission and an approval from the Municipal Assembly, and then they would also need a conditional use approval from the Planning and Zoning Commission for the monofill project. They have are still in the process, and no approvals from either the Planning Commission or the Assembly have been granted yet.
A public hearing is set for August 12th on the conditional use permit that would allow the site to be used for fill. Planning Commission public comment on the master plan itself is closed, although a second public hearing before the Anchorage Assembly is scheduled for next month. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The city of Galena has been awarded a $900,000 grant from the federal government to help it recover from last spring's devastating flooding. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development grant will allow residents to reconnect to city water and sewer service. The agency says the money will also help rebuild the estimated 105 homes that were either destroyed or made uninhabitable after a Yukon River ice jam backed water into Galena in May. A flood watch is in effect for rivers feeding the upper Tanana River in the eastern interior. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says high altitude melting is raising water levels.
We've just had a long period of warm weather, and so our freezing levels are very high. So we're seeing significant glacial melt from the higher mountains in the Alaska Range, specifically in the eastern Alaska Range.
Plum says water is high in rivers draining the Alaska Range to the north, including Nabesna, Shoshana.
Those two rivers are running at or near bank full, and the Tanana River up in the upper Tanana Valley near Tok and Tanacross is right near bank full as well.
Plum says slightly cooler temperatures forecast for the eastern Alaska Range the next few days should slow melting and allow glacial rivers to begin dropping. Yesterday marked the 31st day this summer that it hit or surpassed 80 degrees in Fairbanks, breaking a record set in 2004. It climbed to 85 yesterday, the 13th day it's been 85 or warmer this summer, also a record, besting 12 days in 1918. Fairbanks is expected to add to this summer's run of 80-degree days today and tomorrow. A new documentary tells the story of one of the most riveting stories of disaster at sea, Tragedy and Courage on the Bering Sea by filmmaker John Sabala, chronicles the fire that destroyed the fishing vessel Galaxy in 2002. The story is told entirely by the ship's captain, Dave Shoemaker. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, Shoemaker is now devoting his life to training people who spend their time on the water.
And he said, "Captain." I said, "What? Mirek? What? Are we going to die today?" I said, "Yes, Mirek." We're going to die today.
On October 20th, 2002, Captain Dave Shoemaker and his crew aboard the 180-foot Galaxy were fishing in the Bering Sea, some 30 miles southwest of St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs. About 4:20 p.m., the ship was hit by a very large wave on the starboard side. From all accounts, smoke was immediately detected on multiple decks. Captain Shoemaker was in the wheelhouse when a factory foreman alerted him. Thick black smoke began to fill the bridge.
The next thing I feel is this boat rock violently and this explosion that took place, and now I've got people screaming man overboard.
Before that, it had just been another day on the Freezer longliner.
Within 4 minutes, there had been a huge backdraft explosion that basically destroyed the vessel and most of its survival equipment and all of their safety plans and procedures.
Seattle area filmmaker John Sabella has produced the documentary.
This catastrophe occurred so fast, it just overwhelmed the crew.
The documentary condenses the more than 3 hours between the discovery of smoke to Shoemaker's rescue. He was the last man on the burning ship.
I'm asking people to jump off the back of a boat that's 34 feet out of the water at the dock and add 20-foot seas to that.
Three crew members died, but the rest were rescued, including a National Marine Fisheries observer who was in the frigid water for nearly an hour and a half without a survival suit. Shoemaker had been with the Bering Sea Fleet for nearly 30 years, but this was the near-death experience no one ever expects. Good Samaritan boats broke off their fishing to help rescue the Galaxy crew. Later, skippers called him in the hospital where he recovered from burns.
They said, you know, Dave, if it could happen to you, it can happen to any of us, and we need to pay closer attention.
Shoemaker now is a Coast Guard certified trainer with the North Pacific Fishing Vessel Owners Association.
Something that I'm going to do for as long as I can do it and get in front of as many fishermen that I can.
He has realized a goal of speaking to cadets at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. He's become a trainer for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, fisheries. It wasn't that Shoemaker or his crew had not trained for emergencies before. Training was part of their work.
I think one of the things that happens in the fleet, everybody becomes calloused at one particular point or another, because we don't have the experience to relate to, or we've not had the emergency we had to deal with. We've become a little bit hardened to the fact that it could in fact happen.
Shoemaker knows there were mistakes made that day. Throughout the film, he talks about trying to regain control of his crew and the ship. The Coast Guard report of the Galaxy fire and sinking calls his actions extraordinarily brave and heroic. He and two other crew members were given Coast Guard commendations.
23 people managed to survive, and I attribute that to the effort and energy and the heroism of every individual on that vessel that day.
He estimates that most of the Galaxy crew members have left fishing. His therapy for dealing with the trauma is to help other fishermen achieve through training what he calls a level of unconscious competence in emergency response. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Eric Newman. This week on AK, Fish Camp. Dotting the coastline of Cook Inlet, from Nanilchik to Nikiski, are some of the Kenai Peninsula's oldest businesses. Many of these commercial fish camps are still owned and operated by the families that started them two or three generations ago. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has a closer look at the family traditions that are at the center of the culture of set netting.
Nobody can sleep through that, can they?
No.
On this section of beach near the mouth of the Kisilov River, generations of commercial fishermen are back for another season. And this is their version of an alarm clock, pelting the front of a cabin with beach rocks until its occupant, no doubt groggy from a long day of hauling in sockeye, comes out, if for no other reason than to stop the barrage.
Yeah, and we just throw rocks at them and they learn really fast. Yeah.
As I've seen some of these camps in action this summer, the thing that sticks out the most is the distinct culture around each one. There are actually a couple of camps here, but the crews mingle freely and they share a lot. You might call Nancy Taylor the matriarch of this clan. She and her husband Alec bought the site 30 years ago. They didn't plan to fish, but eventually they did get a permit and learned the ropes from a guy named Harry Nan, who, as Nancy explains, didn't really do much to help flatten out the learning curve. Routine duties like picking buoys out of the water were mastered through trial and error.
So we went out there. I had a skiff. I was in it all by myself, a little tiny skiff. And then he and Alec were in another one. And I grabbed a hold of the buoy and I just went around and around and around. I couldn't get it in the boat.
Taylor fishes next to the Johnston family. They call themselves the Salmon People. They fished for Alec and Nancy Taylor for a few years before buying their own site. Now the second generation is fishing, and a third generation is, well, they're kids, so mostly they're just playing on the beach. But that's really the essence of what most of these camps are all about, family. For 3 months each year, family come from all over, or very close friends, and they spend the summer on the beach.
This is our tool shed.
This site is the product of 3 decades of additions, rebuilds, and quick fixes. There's a row of disheveled-looking cabins backed up along the bluff, and each one has its own personality. Some have their own names. Some of those names can't be repeated on the radio. It's a kind of lifestyle living out on the beach, and a Spartan one at that. They only got running water about a decade ago.
This is an old buoy that they used to use, and Mel turned that into a sink.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, this is our cook shack.
About a 45-minute drive up the beach to Salamatoff, it's largely the same story for the Frostad fishing crew. Sarah Frostad Hudkins and her husband Jason are the third generation, and their kids are crew members now. Her grandfather built the cabin that they all stay in 90 years ago.
And it's emotional to me in, like, the weirdest way, because it's, you don't get to play and work with your kids like this anyplace else. We were talking before you came down, it's like my happiest moments have been here. My scariest moments have been here.
Like a lot of set netters, the Frostad crew has other work the rest of the year. Fishing being what it is, there's just no guarantee that a summer's work will pay enough to get you through the year. In 2012, Alaska Fish and Game managers were concerned about alarmingly low returns of king salmon, and set netters were only allowed in the water for a few brief fishing periods. It was hardly enough to pay for the gas in their boats. In the off-season, the crew scatters a bit, mostly down to Washington State, where Sarah's daughter, Shayla, is going to school to become a teacher. That way she can come back every summer and be with the family.
It's like the most unique time you can have with your family. It's something that everyone can do and everyone can partake in. It's just so unique, and I know I would come up here even if I didn't make an ounce of anything. I would just come up here because I love it, and I get to spend every day with my family, working hard, playing hard, having fun, laughing, maybe a couple tears, just a little bit of everything.
Back down in Coho, my nickel tour of the camp is wrapped up, and I'm thinking about trying to get one of their beach games started. Maybe a game of the Wheel of Misfortune.
I walk away. Once that wheel starts spinning, I walk away.
It takes a lot more whiskey, and not a 5 a.m. set, usually.
Okay, no taker. Sounds like that's not something that would be good to do on a school night. So instead, they cap the night by pulling out the guitars.
Your tiny eyes looked up at me. The bottom of my boat, they spoke to me. They said, I know where I'm going. I'm headed up back to the river.
For AK, I'm Shailen Cochran.
Back to the river. Where have all the kings?
Now it's time for 300 villages. This week on AK, we're heading to Wiseman, a tiny community in Alaska's high Arctic.
I'm Jack Rekoff, and I
I'm a subsistence user. I also work as a tour guide in the summertime. Wiseman, Alaska is in the south slope of the Brooks Range. The Brooks Range is about 135 miles wide. There's 5,000 mountains on both sides of a 2-mile-wide valley in Wiseman. It's probably one of the smaller villages in Alaska. It's 13 people that live here year-round. It's a historical gold mining community. It has about 35 different cabin structures here that are built between 1905 and 1915 would be the majority. There's some that are here that are built as late as the 40s. There's the five households here, or two households. All of the households burn wood for heat because of the high cost of heating oil. So we have timber in the south slope of the Brooks Range. Hunt animals primarily for meat. There's not a lot of fishery here, so we don't have fish to a large degree. Then there's two households that have small bed and breakfast lodging accommodation, and there's about 8,000 to 10,000 people that travel the road going past here, over 3 miles off the Dalton Highway, and there's people that go past here going up to the Arctic Ocean. Beautiful big mountains here. People climb hills and just roaming around looking at wildflowers. We would like to be hiking the mountains and going up some of the creeks to get grayling. But everybody here is very, very busy doing either their lodging or doing their summer work. Like most rural Alaska, the work season is in summer.
Jack Rekoff lives in Wiseman, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shaylin Cochran, Annie Fite, Alex Duer, and Kristen Spack. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Eric Newman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Eric Newman in Sitka, Ben Matheson in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.